continue first with a with words from Sister Colombo and from Brother David, speaking from the perspective as Christian monastics on monastic life. We'll have about an hour for that. And then we'll take a half an hour for walking meditation, just to stretch after the meal and sitting. And then have another hour for discussion. And then close for the from 4:30 to 5 with a meditation and some chanting as a way to end today.
Thank you. I apologize for having to read my paper, but I hope that I can make it much more personal. It's a very autobiographical account, and so I'm hoping, too, that you'll find that interesting. It's called My Monastic Journey. It began on May 24th, 1951, when I entered the monastery of Mount St. Mary's Abbey in Wrentham, Massachusetts, a Cistercian abbey, popularly known as Trappist or Trappistine in the feminine branch. I was 24 years old and had been employed as a social worker for a short time in Vermont, which was where I was born, and after some graduate work in New York City. I first heard of the Cistercians in 1949, when Thomas Merton's Seven-Story Mountain was the rage. And I remember being curled up in a chair in our living room, devouring that book, and thinking that I'd like to do what he did, enter a monastery, because it seemed to me that it was the perfect place to learn to love God and to love one's neighbor. But I didn't know of any Cistercian monasteries for women. The idea of becoming a nun had been with me off and on since childhood. And when I finished high school, I had decided that's what I would do, but I was in no hurry. I wanted to get away from home, to have some fun, and to see the world. And New York City is about as much of the world as I saw until I entered the cloister. And after that, I saw a whole lot more of it. California, for example. And it's not unusual that I thought of becoming a nun, because almost every Catholic girl who's been educated by sisters entertains the idea at least briefly. And the sisters I knew were teachers or nurses, and I didn't want to be either. I thought a missionary or a contemplative was much more my style, but I was willing to wait. However, by the time 1950 came along, I was beginning to feel some urgency. And one evening I confided my desire to a good friend. I was astonished when she told me that she had applied to the Trappistines and was going there to visit at the end of April. Would I like to go along? So I was thrilled, and I went. It was to Mount St. Mary's Abbey, which was the first house of Trappistines in the States. It was a monastery founded by Irish nuns. Actually, it was love at first sight. I listened in awe to the thin little voices singing Gregorian chant, coming over the grill and the curtain. I was in the guest chapel. I peeked through the fence, because they were cloistered nuns, and could see them walking in their khaki-colored raincoats with hoods, single file in silence to the cow barn, and I was enthralled. And then the ultimate was to watch them trundling their wheelbarrows out of the barn over a wooden ramp to empty the manure in a spreader below. And I thought I'd never seen anything quite like it. It was just what Merton had described, only better. And my friend was not enchanted. I think she felt a bit queasy. Some years later, she entered another religious group. But I was so overcome that when we had the opportunity of speaking to the abbess behind the grill and the curtain, I couldn't even tell her my name. My friend had to speak for both of us. It was a year later that I was received into the community. And in the meantime, I had had a short interview with the abbess, almost face to face, because the curtain was opened so we could see each other, but behind a grill. And I hadn't met any of the other nuns, and I hadn't seen the inside of the monastery. So I presented myself on the morning of May 24th, wearing a tweed suit and green shoes. As soon as I was clothed in the postulant's habit, which was awaiting me in my trunk, it was a black serge, long black gown and cape, black veil, black shoes. I felt very nun-like indeed, and I just hugged myself that night in sheer delight because I was finally a nun. But I didn't realize I had a long way to go. The first surprise that I received on entering the cloister was that it was bright inside. Without knowing it, I had pictured it as being very dark and gloomy, like some other convents I had known. But it was very bright. It was built around a cloister garth, a garden. So it was lovely, really. The next surprise came when I sat on my bed. A machine-packed straw mattress on boards that felt to me like a marble slab. And then the next thing was the silence. No one spoke to me except the novice mistress and the abbess, and the abbess very little. None of the other sisters, although there were lots of smiles and hugs, and I began learning the Trappist sign language, so pretty soon I could communicate with my fingers. But we didn't speak in those days. And I learned afterward that my green shoes had created quite a stir when I walked through the novitiate. So the day went something like this. Up at 2 a.m., in the church at 2:10 to chant the office of the Virgin Mary, in the dark and from memory. At 2:30, lights on for the divine office, which consisted of 12 psalms and 2, 3, or 4 other readings, depending on the day. Lights out for half an hour of meditation. Lights on for lauds, which meant more psalms and readings, followed sometimes by the office of the dead, more psalms and readings. Then to the dormitory to make up our beds, and for those who wore habits, to change from the one they slept in to the day one, to wash one's face and be back in the church in 20 minutes for the first Mass. Sometimes I'd collapse onto the bed exhausted, but terrified of being found out or falling asleep and missing the whole thing. After the Mass, as I remember it, it was to the refectory for bread and coffee, then back to the church for the office of prime, to the chapter room for the reading of the rule, and perhaps some instruction by the abbess. 20 minutes to a half hour for spiritual reading, followed by another Mass, which we sang, and finally out to work. Then we were back in the church by midday for another office, followed by dinner. After dinner, a siesta was mandatory in summer, a walk outside in winter. It seemed to me it should have been just the other way around. The afternoon began with an office in the church, then work, an interval of an hour or so for reading, vespers, meditation, supper, a short interval, about 15 minutes of public pious reading, the office of Compline, and so to bed at 8 o'clock. As you can see, we spent a busy day. The liturgy was totally in Latin, sung for the most part. The work in the barn and the fields was exhausting, and the diet meager. The novice mistress with whom we were supposed to talk had her hands full with some 20 odd in the novitiate, so the time between talks was sometimes pretty long. I was homesick, I was tired, I was happy, and frightened most of all of being sent away. And it's easy to account for the homesickness and for the fatigue, but what about the happiness? Well, I was being a Trappistine, and Trappistines, as far as I was concerned, were the best there were. They ranked higher than other religious in the church, and whatever it took to be one, I was willing to give. Besides, having been raised as what is known as an Irish Catholic, I carried my burden of guilt, and I was making reparation for my own sins and the sins of others. And I was saving my own soul, and only God knew how many others. And I was giving glory to God. There was also a great beauty in the life, in the celebration of the liturgical year, all the different feasts, the saints, the holy days, a real liturgical life that I'd never experienced before. There was a very prayerful, peaceful atmosphere. The physical surroundings were beautiful. The opportunity to pray, to read, although they were rather limited, and to learn about God were all very satisfying. And then I was in this thing with a group of high-spirited, good-humored, generous, and loving young women. The days wore on. I remember sometime after I received the novice's habit, I'd perhaps been in the monastery a year, and I timidly asked the novice mistress when the spiritual life was going to begin. And I was dismayed to hear that this was the spiritual life. I expected it would be different, that I would be different. I was like the fish in the pond that wonders what water is like. And all through the years, that feeling that somehow I had missed it, whatever it was, never entirely left me. When I'd been 4 years in the monastery, I received the job of cellarer, or housekeeper. It meant buying the food, planning the meals, distributing the work, seeing to the maintenance of the house and the grounds. I held the job for 9 years, but as the community grew, the job was divided up more and more among other people. And in the Rule of Saint Benedict, which we read every day in the chapter, there's a beautiful section entitled, On What Kind of Man the Cellarer Ought to Be. And it speaks of the patience, the humility, the kindness that the cellarer should show, and I'm sure it's made many a cellarer squirm. And more than once it fell to me to read it. And on one occasion, when I had taken my place after the reading of the rule, the abbess said, "Well, if you don't have the kind of person Saint Benedict recommends, you use the person you've got." So by 1964, the community had grown to 74 members in a house that was built for 60, and it was time for a foundation. We obtained property in Iowa, and in May of that year, I was appointed superior of the group that would go out in October. And by this time, a good number of mitigations had been introduced, touching on the horarium, the diet, and silence. The number of vocal prayers had been reduced to allow for more personal prayer and time for Lectio Divina. That's a particularly monastic practice, a meditative reading of the scriptures, which will lead to prayer and contemplation. Time for study and spiritual reading. The hour of rising was changed to 3 a.m. Milk, cheese, and even fish were permitted. Talking was allowed at certain times. Community dialogues became part of the way of life. And all this with a view to creating a better balance, improving the health of the members, and promoting both human and spiritual development. In Iowa, we didn't have a dairy, but supported ourselves by the manufacture of caramels, because part of our rule is self-support, and every Trappist and Trappistine monastery finds some way. Mostly, it used to be farming, but now it's some sort of food product, it seems. Jams and jellies and bread and fruit cakes and candy and cheese and anything that can sell as food. We continued working in the fields. With a new foundation, the question is always whether or not it will prove viable. Will the members from the mother house bond together in the new situation to form a community? Will the group be able to support itself? And will they attract new members? So we succeeded on all counts, thanks to a providence that protected and guided us, and a community that was willing, generous, and hardworking. In 1970 and again in 76, I was elected abbess of the community, Our Lady of the Mississippi Abbey, as it's called. It was an office I held until 1982, when I decided that I didn't want to stand for a third term. So when a new abbess was elected in May of that year, to give her a chance to get established and to give myself some space and time, I asked for a year's leave. I went to Bolivia, where I was to work with a friend to set up a monastic house of prayer. It never materialized, although we did eventually build a kind of retreat house. And as it turned out, I was in Bolivia for 4.5 years. I lived part of the time in a hermitage in the Andes Mountains among Quechua people. And the rest of my time was spent in the city of Cochabamba, because the monk that I was with became more and more involved in social concerns, taking care of orphans, building a clinic, and building this retreat house. But actually, my resonance was with the campo, living in the hermitage in the mountains. But after 4.5 years, I realized I couldn't be separated much longer from my community. And I came back with the hope that two or three sisters might return with me to Bolivia. Not exactly as a foundation, but simply to give that experience to some other members of my community, an exposure to a different culture and to the poverty of the third world. But I had been home just 3 weeks when I received a call from England asking if I'd be willing to act as superior of our house there that was in some difficulty and needed a superior for a couple of years. So I went and I stayed there 2 years. I came home last October, back to my own community in Iowa. So now my years of being in charge are ended, and in a certain sense, I stand once more on the threshold of monastic life, minus the green shoes and minus some of my romanticism. And if you ask me what has it all meant, I'm not sure that I know fully. I think there's still time for a lot of reflection and integration on all that's happened in my monastic life. But I do know that many of my ideas have changed. And I blush when I recall that I thought the Trappistines were the best there were, because I no longer believe that there are any best. I believe that God loves us all, and that it doesn't matter much what we decide to do, provided that we set out along the road that leads to wholeness or wisdom or enlightenment or whatever we choose to call that fulfillment of the human potential to, as I put it, to know the truth and love the good. And I'm not sure I know fully what that means, but I guess we all have a general idea. And I was quite sure about everything when I came to monastic life. I could have answered any question. Now I'm sure of almost nothing. And I said earlier that I had thought that as a nun I would save my soul and the souls of others. And I understand better now the gratuitousness of salvation as a gift to be received rather than a reward to be earned. And I've also come to believe in the mutuality of human persons, and that I'm saved or healed by the love and the suffering and the sacrifices of my brothers and sisters in the world, just as I hope that my life is of some benefit to them. And because my life is a Christian monastic life, it can't be understood apart from Jesus Christ. And the renunciations, the prayer, the reading, the meditation of the Bible, the give and take of community life, everything is aimed at helping a person to set aside the false or the egotistical self, and as St. Paul has it, to put on Christ. Paul also says, I live now, not I, but Christ lives in me. So however clumsily we might express it, or however dimly we may grasp it, it seems to me that that is the general aim of the Christian life, and the aim of the monastic life in particular. And it necessitates dying, a dying to this selfish self. And all my life I've managed to evade that ultimate surrender to God, which is the death I'm speaking of. And certainly there have been little deaths here and there, but to be as Jesus described it, the seed that falls into the ground and dies is just too demanding and too threatening. Even though I know, as Jesus also pointed out, that unless the grain of wheat dies, it remains only a grain of wheat. And if it dies, it bears much fruit. But the self that wants to be special, to dominate, to control, to have its needs and desires fulfilled, in spite of what it may mean for others, the self that wants to determine what's right and wrong, good and evil, is very tenacious. And it's not even by our own efforts alone that we can put it to death. It's more a question of the willingness to let it die, or maybe of the grace to accept the grace to be willing to let it die. And words get very confusing, and perhaps it might be well just to leave it at that. And to say that I still have the hope that I will one day open to that grace that ever knocks on the door of our hearts. So I'd like to end with one of my favorite passages from the Bible. It's from the book of the Old Testament called Lamentations. "This I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the soul that seeks him. It is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord." So I don't know whether I should be open for some questions.
If you'd like to
now,
take a
or
bit.
I don't want to take too much time,
well,
though, because...
Time. Go ahead, please, for a bit.
Do you have a criterion for what you consider to be appropriate ways to make a living to support yourself?
I don't know that we have it written any place, but... I know some of our sisters, especially the younger ones, are questioning whether it's right to be making candy. I don't question it myself. But because sugar is so bad for you. And but we do try, you know, to use good ingredients in the candy and have a high standard of production.
I know there's a lot of talk about, in the Catholic Church, about vocation, how to determine if one has a vocation. Having seen a lot of nuns come and go, I'm sure, over the years,
yes.
Do you have anything, have you noticed anything that seems to you to be indicative of the people that do have a vocation to do spirit?
I think it requires certain abilities, you know, the ability to live with others in community, because we have a very, very strong community life. And in the Catholic Church, I think there was a time when people felt called to religious life, and they didn't particularly want it. You know, I feel that I should be a nun, or I must be a nun. But I don't believe in that at all. I think we are monks and nuns, and you discover that you are. You know, I don't think you get a vocation. I think it's like being a painter or a poet, or it's in the heart. And you may have to try various styles of life before you find the one that fits, but that's about all I can say about it. You know, you find that you're home when you belong, and sometimes you have to have pretty good health too. So that can be a drawback sometimes. Well, I think meditation for us means something different than for you, although just recently some of our sisters have made a kind of, I don't know whether to call it a Zen Christian. Sister Trinitas would know better how to call it. Yeah, she was in a Zendo in Japan, I think, for a good number of years. So these five sisters made a retreat with this sister, and they practiced the sitting and the walking. So when they came back, they invited any of the other community members to join. So I'm part of that group now, and we're trying to do the you know, emptying the mind, and we're trying. But in our tradition, meditation formally meant like taking a saying from the Bible or something you had read and meditating on that, getting the meaning for you in your own personal life and development. But whereas before our day was filled up with vocal prayers, and now we have what we call vigils at 3:15, then from 4 o'clock until 6:30, we're free for meditation and reading and prayer, whatever. And then throughout the day, there are periods of an hour or so. And then 2 or 3 afternoons a week, we have free for meditation and prayer. And yes. Yes, actually, all kinds of things are acceptable, but it didn't used to be that way. We only did spiritual reading, the gospel, the Bible, and then devotional works. But now we have a large library, and we don't have too much pornographic literature. But all other things are acceptable. Well, actually, I was in favor of it, although I loved the chant. But I feel we spent an awful lot of time practicing the chant, because there was a standard of excellence, and it's not easy to sing. And so for our times and for the people who are coming in, the vernacular seems to fit much better. And I find it helpful to pray and to recite the Psalms in my own language. But there's a beauty certainly that was lost with the chant. And I believe that someday somebody will discover it again and the whole cycle will start over again.
One of the things that looks like a difference between Buddhist and Christian approaches to spirituality is the place of technique. And I was wondering if you could say a couple of words about perhaps the difference between grace as a focus in Christian spirituality, technique in Buddhist spirituality, or could you say something about grace in that sense, in that context?
Well, I don't think I would oppose grace to technique. I think that we did have our techniques, which were different. You know, the Lectio Divina that I mentioned was really the way we were introduced to prayer, to reading the Gospels and reflecting. And grace, as I see it, is operative in every human being. It's grace that moves you, that you just can't put your finger on what grace is. So maybe I didn't understand your question too well.
In the end, it would be you are led to contemplation rather than sort of finding your way to it, something like that.
Well, there are different types of contemplation. You know, there's the infused and the acquired, and certainly to come to that that state of contemplation that we call infused is a grace. It's something that you can't do on your own. But I think that's part of the Buddhist teaching too, isn't it? That you don't do it on your own. You have certain techniques, but then if you come to enlightenment, it's a gift, isn't it?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.